The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Maureen McDonald for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I'll be reading to you from the October 2025 Walter Magazine. We begin in the music department with Racing Ahead. North Carolina's Music Hall of Fame is a very old North State experience by David Menconi. Upon entering the North Carolina Music Hall of Fame, it's possible the first thing you notice won't be music-related. That's because the Music Hall shares space with the North Carolina Motorsports Hall of Fame, so race cars are on display. The joint facility is the Curb Museum for Music and Motorsports, named for benefactor Mike Curb in Kannapolis. It's actually very cool to have the race cars here, says Veronica Cordell, executive director of the Music Hall of Fame since 2017. When we first moved in here, I did wonder, how would this work? But it's a beautiful combination. This area is so saturated with both music and motorsports, it works perfectly. NASCAR's roots go back to Prohibition-era moonshine runners, but our state's musicians have made monumental contributions to American music. From Doc Watson to Nina Simone, John Coltrane and Earl Scruggs on down, there truly are enough genius-level artists to fill a Music Hall of Fame. You'll find displays about all those artists at the hall. There are 132 inductees going back a century, from Roaring Twenties pre-bluegrass pioneer Charlie Poole up to present-day stars like country singer Luke Combs, who's going in this year. The number one thing I hear from people who come is they just are totally floored because they can't believe how much greatness comes from North Carolina, says Cordell. I never knew so-and-so was from here, they'll say. Roberta Flack, Randy Travis, and all the rest. It really is unbelievable. The North Carolina Music Hall of Fame originated in the 1990s in Thomasville when a group of music fans started collecting memorabilia to display. Curb, a politician and longtime music industry mogul, as well as leader of hit-making Christian pop band Mike Curb Congregation, got involved in 2008 and moved it to Kannapolis, where he owned a NASCAR racing team. It was Curb's idea to combine music and motorsports in one building, and he's the operation's major underwriter. According to Cordell, Curb provides between 60 and 70% of its funding, which is enough to make admission free. It's hard to pinpoint how many music halls of fame exist in America. Bob Santelli, who has had key roles at the Grammy Hall of Fame in Los Angeles and Seattle's Experience Music Project, puts the number at about 36. From big institutions like the Country or Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, down to modest mom-and-pop operations. State Halls of Fame have a tough time because most of their visitors are going to be from within that state, says Santelli, now founding executive director of the Bruce Springsteen Archives and Center for American Music at New Jersey's Monmouth University. But they're still great and necessary. Huge museums like the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame can't tell all the stories or preserve all the history. That's why the smaller halls of fame are valuable. While the pandemic shutdown took a toll, Cordell says the hall has seen its annual attendance double since then to around 6,000 a year, mostly from school groups coming for tours. Among the most popular artifacts on display are a golden fiddle from Wilmington native Charlie Daniels of The Devil Went Down to Georgia fame and Grammy Awards on loan from Troutman-born Americana star Jim Lauderdale and Newton bluegrass fiddle legend Bobby Hicks. An advisory board selects inductees from a running list of nearly 400 names based on influence and artistry. Most, but not all, are native-born, and the vast majority are recording artists, but the membership does include a few non-performers, like Motown Records executive and Climax native Clarence Avant. Membership has become coveted enough for Cordell to regularly get inquiries from musicians lobbying for induction. It's a cool thing. Very nice of them to think of our band as worthy of inducting, alongside George Clinton, Maceo Parker, so many others, says Hope Nichols, whose alternative rock band, Fetchin' Bones, was inducted in 2023 and did not have to lobby for it. It's a building full of cool things, and we had a lot of fun curating our exhibit. We gave them so much stuff, costumes and instruments and handmade posters, crazy DIY things we did through the years. The latest class was inducted this month at the Mooresville Performing Arts Center, a class of six led by country hitmaker Combs. Also entering this year are cult favorite roots rocker Dexter Romweber, country pedal steel guitarist Clyde Maddox, singer-songwriter David Childers, pioneering radio DJ Hattie Chatty Hattie Leaper, and director-producer Robert Deaton. This year's ceremony will have to go a long way to top the hall's most memorable induction of platinum-selling country star Eric Church in 2015. The Granite Falls native wasn't supposed to be there, sending relatives to accept on his behalf, but unexpectedly appeared after all. His mom was in the middle of reading Eric's acceptance speech, apologizing for not being there, when all of a sudden he walked on stage, says Cordell. Surprised everybody, and there was an amazing eruption from the audience. That was the best. Next up, Fertile Soil, a service-driven garden on a former tobacco farm, by Helen Yost. 9 years ago, Francis and Barrett Kane's two-acre plot in the Carey's Reach area was a compact lot with untilled dirt that once housed storage barns for an adjoining tobacco farm. The Kanes weren't gardeners when they lived in Northern Virginia before retiring to Raleigh, but you'd never know this from what they've accomplished, turning the barren land into an oasis of beautiful plantings on fertile soil. It was no easy task, Barrett jokingly says. We have the pain and surgeries to prove it. As busy professionals, Francis and Barrett had little time for hobbies for much of their lives. Both worked for USAID in Washington, D.C., and Barrett also worked with the Small Business Administration and the Veterans Administration. Their dream, however, was to move to Raleigh to own land where they could build a garden. Neither had much experience gardening. Francis grew a few flowers, and Barrett took care of the lawn. But my parents had an interest in horticulture, with Mom growing flowers and Dad growing roses, Francis says. And during the visits to her grandparents' farm in Southampton, Virginia, Francis says her grandmother, aunt, and uncle would let her, quote, playfully work the rows of peanuts and tobacco. In 2014, the Kanes bought this property from Homes by Dickerson, a local custom builder, then worked with them to build their home. After purchasing the lot, Francis asked the builder, who owns the land next to us? Turns out the builder owned the lot next door, too. So Francis offered a quick follow-up. Can we buy it? The Canes were able to purchase the second lot, which was full of hardwood trees, and they left that land as it was. With land already purchased in Raleigh, they listed their home in Fairfax, Virginia, but didn't anticipate how quickly it would sell. "We had no choice but to find temporary housing," says Francis. "We put most of our things in storage and rented a room at an extended living hotel in Fairfax for 8 months, traveling to Raleigh weekly or biweekly to check on the building progress. Even with the storage unit, there were boxes all around." It was the first real test of their marriage, she half jokes, since they'd been wed just 2 years before. Once they moved in, the Canes began working the land that would surround the house. "We found all sorts of tools and such from where the old tobacco barn disintegrated," says Barrett. "There were gears, plow parts, ball joints, tin, barbed wire, and old barn wood. And there were so many rocks that had to be cleared, as well as roots," adds Francis, figuring that the rocks were used as edging for earlier garden beds. They amended the compacted soil with pine bark, homemade compost, and humus compost, then added layers of plants to the new beds, with the goal of having something blooming each season, starting with liriope along the bed edges. "Things are now growing into each other. The pruning seems nonstop," says Francis. While Francis designed the flower beds, Barrett tended to the lawn and the vegetables in the raised beds he'd built. "We didn't have grandiose garden plans. We just went forward with what we could do ourselves," says Francis. Together, they created walking paths throughout. They also grew in containers. "I have an herb garden with oregano, rosemary, and thyme at the back kitchen door where I can easily snip, snip, snip," says Francis. "In the summer, they'll grow squash, tomatoes, Swiss chard, peppers, and cucumbers. We tried melons this year, but they require way too much space," she adds, "and the figs really showed off this year, way more than we can eat." The Canes are environmentally conscious. "We don't use any chemicals and keep the garden as natural as possible." "When I started the garden," Francis says, "native plants weren't talked about like they are now, but I am working to incorporate more." Barrett adds, "We have oodles of birds and other friendly wildlife, too." Today they're reaping their rewards and sharing with others as they host garden tours and events with their church, First Baptist in Raleigh. "We talk a good game about enjoying the garden, but seldom get to do so on a regular basis," says Francis. "Though we do have parties on the back porch, complete with table arrangements from the yard." In addition, they volunteer with the Raleigh chapter of International Focus, a nonpartisan nonprofit that promotes understanding between North Carolinians and the international community. So far, they've hosted 5 groups, including parliamentarian members, judges, and attorneys from Moldova and a group from Serbia. Francis has also gotten involved with the gardening community. She's the past president of the Raleigh Garden Club and currently serves as the 3rd vice president of the Garden Club of North Carolina. Francis is a true pioneer and trailblazer, making history as the first African-American officer in the Garden Club of North Carolina, says Charles McClendon, president of the Garden Club of NC. "She's a joy to work with, and her service inspires and uplifts us all." When their blended family of 8 children visited, they gave the garden a name, Canes Park. It's fitting for all they've accomplished. "We enjoy seeing the results of our gardening chores," says Francis. From the Nature Department, the cleanup crew. Vultures may look scary, but they play a critical role in our environment. By Mike Dunn. October in the Piedmont means cooler nights, the start of fall color, and families preparing for some people's favorite holiday, Halloween. Of course, Halloween is a time for treats, but it's also a season full of eerie stories and images. I don't usually think of the natural world as a scary place, but plenty of people associate certain critters with spooky traits. Spiders, snakes, and bats, for starters. Another local creature that some view as having a ghoulish reputation, vultures. Why are vultures perceived as scary? Perhaps it's because we often associate death with scary scenes, and vultures specialize in making dead things into a diet. Often, when they're featured in movies, they're circling above someone in a desolate place, waiting for an unkind ending. And to be fair, the vulture's appearance itself is a little frightening, as it resembles a feathered grim reaper, with its dark coloration, naked head, and scythe-like bill. In the early 1900s, there were public calls to kill vultures due to fears of them spreading diseases from the dead animals they consumed. But the truth is just the opposite. Vultures help stop the spread of disease and reduce numbers of unwanted scavengers, like feral dogs and rats, by removing animal carcasses from our environment. Some vultures, in fact, have stomach acids 100 times stronger than ours, with a pH similar to your car's battery acid. This allows them to safely consume decomposing animals and help neutralize any pathogens they encounter. Vultures are key members of nature's cleanup crew and play a critical role in helping recycle the nutrients from dead animals back to the soil. North Carolina has two species of vultures, the black vulture and the turkey vulture. Turkey vultures are larger and dark brown in color, and adults have reddish skin on their heads. The resemblance to the head of a wild turkey is the origin of their common name. Black vultures are slightly smaller, with dark gray heads and black feathers. In flight, turkey vultures are able to soar on their 6-foot wingspan for hours, with wings held in a slight V shape called a dihedral. Turkey vultures' dihedral shape gives them a more stable flight and minimizes the need for flapping, undoubtedly saving them considerable energy. Black vultures tend to flap more and hold their wings almost flat across, similar to many other raptors like hawks and eagles. They also have a shorter tail and whitish patches at their wingtips when viewed from below. Black vultures have become much more abundant in our area in recent decades, and studies show they're rapidly expanding their range northward and increasing population numbers. Though most of their diet is dead animals, black vultures have been known to kill small live animals, such as opossums and even the occasional young livestock. Turkey vultures tend to feed singly or in small groups. They have one of the best senses of smell in the bird world, with olfactory bulbs much larger than their black vulture brethren. Studies have shown that turkey vultures can find even small dead animals that have been hidden in stumps or hollow logs using their well-developed sense of smell. Black vultures must rely much more on their vision, and they often follow a turkey vulture to a kill site and then quickly take it over by the force of sheer numbers. Vultures often congregate on bare branches with their huge wings outstretched, looking as if they want to welcome you into a gloomy embrace. Though ominous in appearance, it's a behavior that can serve many functions, including drying wet feathers, thermoregulation, especially to warm up by turning their backs to the sun, and exposing their feathers to the sun to help rid them of parasites. Vultures lack a voice box, so they can only make harsh sounds like grunts, growls, and hisses. One of a vulture's last lines of defense is to regurgitate if threatened. Needless to say, when your last meal was a dead animal, that can be a foul-smelling substance. And at the other end, vultures have a unique way of cooling off when it's hot. They defecate on their legs and feet, called urohydrosis. This helps reduce their body temperature through evaporative cooling. In spite of their many unusual and smelly habits, vultures are well adapted to their unique lifestyle and play an important role as nature's recyclers. This article was edited for Time. From the gardening section, A Full Fall by Helen Yost. On October 7th, we had a full moon, known as the Hunter's Moon. Many full moon names date back to Native Americans who used their cycles to keep track of the seasons. As the name might suggest, it's the time of year when folks traditionally prepare for the winter by hunting and gathering. While I won't be out shooting anything, I'm certainly gathering a harvest from my garden. Perennials like Joe Pye weed, garden phlox, and salvias benefit from a slight cutback this time of year. I trim them to about 6 to 8 inches of stalk, which leaves enough to remain a habitat for wildlife. While most of the cutback plant material can go in your compost pile, you'll want to avoid putting in anything with diseased foliage. Instead, bag it up and dispose of it in the trash. If you love a kaleidoscope of colors in the spring, plant your bulbs now, before the first hard frost. Dutch tulips will put on an unmatched show, but are not perennial in our area, so they must be planted annually. If you want more longevity for your efforts, consider perennials like hyacinths, daffodils, and crocuses. October is also the ideal time to plant trees or shrubs, and you'll find an abundant selection of southern favorites, such as jasmine, oaks, and camellias at garden centers. You might also consider adding fruit-bearing plants, like muscadine grapes, pawpaw, or blueberry bushes. Not only will you be rewarded with tasty treats come summer, you'll also help the early spring pollinators. Blueberries, in particular, make a great hedgerow, so if you're looking for privacy, they're a delicious option. From the endnote, a fuller story. As the next phase of renovation begins at the North Carolina Museum of History, community input and interaction is at the forefront, by Anne-Monique Clark. If you've driven around downtown lately, you've probably noticed the fencing around the North Carolina History Museum building. The site has been closed for a year, so this more visible phase of its renovation has gotten locals asking, "What's been going on?" says C.J. Roberts, the executive director of the North Carolina Division of State History Museums. "We've been moving more than 150,000 artifacts, from the size of a pottery shard to an airplane," he says. "It's a Herculean task. Imagine packing your grandmother's china times 150,000. The museum recently released plans for the renovated museum, which will reorient the entrance toward the north side of Bicentennial Plaza, create a light-filled atrium, and add classrooms and community spaces, in addition to doing infrastructure improvements to update accessibility, install new climate control systems, and repair leaks. From the outside point of view, the 1994 building will have bigger windows to tease what's inside, plus wood cladding and other updated architectural details. The museum was sort of stopped in time, says Roberts. Today, there are 4 million more people in the state. Over the last 30-plus years, he notes, North Carolina has become more diverse, and the museum has continued to acquire artifacts. So part of the effort is interviewing communities around the state. We want to tell a fuller story, says Roberts. We want to make sure we offer maximum value and relevance to residents of North Carolina. When the museum reopens, it will have many new features that guests have come to expect, like more digital displays and hands-on experiences. It used to be that the focus was all on the galleries, and that's still a huge part of what we do, but so much of our work now is in developing educational programs and digital content. So we're finding we need things like more studio space, Robert says. The mission doesn't stop within the walls. To that end, Robert wants to remind folks that while the building isn't open, the museum is still hard at work. Our education staff is as busy as they've ever been, he says, nodding to efforts to work on a video series in advance of the 250th anniversary of the founding of the United States of America next year, as well as ongoing workshops, lectures, and acquisitions of new material. This project has been years in the making. We want to modernize the building for today and future-proof it for tomorrow, says Roberts. We've run out of time for today's episode of Walter Magazine. Be sure to tune in next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Maureen McDonald. We've run out of time for today's episode of Walter Magazine. Be sure to tune in next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Maureen McDonald for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Walter Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. And thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.